And it doesn't matter what 100 mile you run, you're going to learn a lesson or two. And that is just a known fact. You can have run 200 mile. I'm going to start over. Welcome to another edition.
That was bad.
That I got to raise my game. And I feel that sometimes after being off for a while, you know, you got to run flat. So that was 50 seconds of wasted hard drive space.
I think it will be an edited podcast.
Yeah.
Are we recording?
It's raw and uncut. And that's what's happening with this one. That's where it's going to be. Face, give me a little 1-2.
1-2.
1-3-4-5-6. Check.
I'm not nervous. I got this. Let's just do it.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Scott War.
I'm Stan Kososki.
I'm Jimmy Dean Freeman.
And I'm Kate Martini Freeman.
Today we're going to speak about lessons learned on a 100-mile run. And you just can't run 100 miles without learning a few things. Don't you think, guys?
Yes, 100 miles will school you.
If you go in not knowing a thing, when you come out, you're going to know something. And we've taken each one of our experiences with a recent 100 miler, and we're going to talk about a few lessons that were given to us. The trail will give you some lessons. Scott War has been, he's run Western States 100, and the rest of us recently have come off the San Gabriel Trail at AC 100, and AC is very generous with lesson giving. I will tell you, that is not an easy run.
It's like the Catholic school mother that slapped you on the wrist.
Slaps you on the back of the head, knocks you down into the dirt.
And Don likes to use his AC 100 reference for those of you at home who probably clicked on the name of this podcast. AC 100 is the Angeles Crest 100, one of the original 600 milers in Southern California.
Near Los Angeles, right?
It is. Part of the City of Angels. It starts in Wrightwood, California, on the Mojave Desert side of the San Gabriel Mountain Range, and it finishes in Altadena, a side sister community to Pasadena. And from the Front Range of the San Gabriel Mountains, you can see downtown Los Angeles. You're kind of running towards the city.
Jimmy Dean, are you thinking that the two times that I've run it and have had just a very difficult time is because I don't give Angeles Crest 100 the proper respect by calling it Angeles Crest and shortcutting with AC? Do you think that is one of my primary problems?
I think there are a number of ways that this race likes to slap runners around, and you can respect aspects of the race and not respect other aspects, and that's part of the reason why we would come up with a podcast like this. You come in thinking you're prepared and you've mentally done your homework and you've studied the course. And in the case of Don and myself, we've both run the race before and we come out of it the other side with new lessons each time. So I think that's the exciting thing about 100 milers. Like Don likes to say, it's a thinking man's game, or as in Kate's case, it's a thinking lady's game.
And Jimmy Dean, let's give you props because, you finished in just absolutely fantastic time. You took a silver buckle away from that event, and the rest of us that have joined you on the podcast are proudly wearing something different than silver. And you know, we would like to recognize your great accomplishment, this being your fourth completed effort at Angeles Crest.
I am 3 for 4, so I've done almost everything in Angeles Crest. I have 2 silver buckles, 1 bronze 33-hour buckle, and a DNF. I failed to finish my 2007 attempt.
Yeah, let me ask you, since you've had both the silver, bronze, and a DNF, in which race did you learn the most?
Probably the year I DNF'd. But that said, you continue to refine your plan and refine what you do in the race, and you learn how to sort of think on the fly. And each time I have returned to AC since that DNF, I've gone sub 24. So, but again, I've still been absolutely schooled the last 2 years.
It's so let's. Excuse me, Jimmy. Go ahead.
That was it. It was just a tough race.
And I've run other hundreds, and I would say that for me is by far the toughest, just because of the elevation. The total climb in that is what, 21,000 feet, and the you range from 5,000, then you go up to 9,500 feet, and there it's exposed out there in the high desert. And this year happened to be over 100 degrees out on the trail, is what I understand, and not an easy race. So a lot of difficult variables to add to the experience on that day.
Don, you said 21,000. I think it's 26.5 of climbing and 21.5 of descending.
Well, there's your problem, Don. You weren't training for that kind of altitude.
which is a perfect segue from the number one thing that I have as a takeaway.
Wait. Before you get into that, I have a quick question about the course. You know, all four of you ran AC, and both Jimmy and Don ran it last year. How was the course different this year versus last year?
Well, I think it was longer.
That's not a joke. Oh. They did mismark one section of the course because the course has changed so many times. Between mile 30 and 38, you go from the Eagle's Roost checkpoint to the Cloudburst Summit checkpoint. And in Cooper Canyon, they had to route around part of the Pacific Crest Trail that's shut down. And so you have to run about 2.5-3 miles of Highway 2 road to get to a campground, and then you drop back into Cooper Canyon. When they made that route around, it was an extra half mile, and so they rerouted from the PCT to a fire road to climb out of Cooper Canyon. And this year, for some reason, they went back onto the PCT, which added about a half mile, maybe 0.6 miles, and another 400, 500 feet of climbing. And I know that was an issue for some people, having planned for an 8 mile section and having it turn out to be an 8.5 mile section. It was already one of the tougher sections in the race to begin with. And I think, I don't know, Stan, you got a story to tell about that?
Yes, I do.
So this is Stan's. Stan, this is your first 100-mile run, is that correct?
First AC.
Okay, you, right. You ran
third. I run Western States and Rio del Lago.
Okay, well, I apologize, and I'm lowering a little bit further down in my chair because I feel awful to not recognize that. So, tell us about your experience.
Well, I was planning on a 30-hour finish time, and coming through that section there, I did have a little low point, and when I was climbing out of it, I ended up missing the checkpoint by about 2 minutes, the cutoff for it. And so it's my fault for not seeing and paying attention to the cutoffs, but I guess that particular cutoff was a little quicker than most. And so live and learn, you know, it make me hungry next year. And
how were you feeling physically?
When I got into, Cooper Canyon? What is the stage? When I got into Cloudburst, I felt great. I felt phenomenal. You know, I hiking out of there, and it was just so disappointed for me to turn around and say my day was done. You know, I see a few people up there that looked like they got hit pretty hard. They were sitting down. They got pulled out too. And
But metabolically, you were doing fine. You were on course, feeling okay.
Yeah, I guess as good as you can feel 38 yeah, miles
sure,
in
sure.
Yeah, but no, I actually felt pretty good, and I was really bummed to have been pulled out.
So lesson learned there would be what? What would you do different next time going, you know, into the race?
Pay more attention to the cutoffs and hopefully not have, you know, any difficult times prior to that point. So, you know, just be accountable for what and when you need to be aware, wherever you need to be. So
did you know what the cutoff time was, Stan? And you just didn't have your watch set right, or what was the deal?
Yeah, that's part of the problem. Is I ended up was basing. I didn't that particular checkpoint. No, I did not know. But I did speak with some people on the trail, and this once like I said, once again, this is I also need to be accountable for that. But I was asking other people running when the cutoff or when the checkpoint is. What's the cutoff time for it? And I create a little cheat sheet that tells me when and I need to be where, and I didn't have it this race. I wasn't prepared with that either. And so,
do you run with the GPS watch? Yeah, so you knew your mileage.
Well, that's what another funny part is, like what Jimmy was saying, is that my checkpoint was showing that I was supposed to be at Cloudburst and I wasn't there, and just kept going. It's happened before where it's been off a little bit, but you know, not that much.
And yeah, I recognize there were some issues at that point too. I was looking at my watch and then talking with another runner, asking her where she was at, and we were both like, "What is going on here? How come we should be here by now?" And we just thought it was just one of those circumstances where your watch isn't telling you the truth.
And in that part of the race, I'm still trying to be conservative, so I'm not, especially climbing up to that. That was a pretty good climb out of the Cloudburst, and I was not really pushing it real hard, and just wanted to get up there and move on to the next checkpoint. And it kind of bit me in the behind. So.
And that's the smart thing at AC. You need to, and you guys, please chime in on this. AC is something you want to protect yourself. You cannot crash and all of a sudden go into a deep spot metabolically where you are in trouble, because that course will not let you recover like some other courses that have some flat or has some cool sections. It's relentless and will continue just dragging you down if you're not careful.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty relentless course.
Jimmy, well, Dean, go ahead, Scott.
I was going to say, Don, what was the, this is your second time running, and you had a much, much better race this year than last year. Part of that is because you trained much, much better, and you're in better shape. What did you learn this year?
I wasn't in the shape that I needed to be in to play on that course. I executed much differently this time. I was more conservative and told myself to back off early, and I did, and stayed within myself and ran smart is what I felt that I ran. And then in fact, coming into Chantry Flat Mile 75 before, I was just 16 pounds down, and all the horror stories that I like to repeat anytime that somebody wants to listen to me, and even if they don't, I like to share it with them. And this time I was 3 pounds down at that point, which is perfect. I was just right where I wanted to be. But man, oh man, I think what I learned from one of my takeaways from this particular event, which is the first one on my list because I made about five of them, and it's this, and I could have made 50 of them, but the top five, and the one that I put down was, you need to train in similar environments. That is so, so important. You cannot substitute climbing if it's a hill race. You can't substitute high desert heat if you don't have high desert heat. You can try to make up for it. You can wear, a long sleeve shirt, turn your heater on high, and drive around in your sun-baked car. I mean, that's an option, but does it substitute or make up for being out there in the element and on that same course you're going to be on? What a luxury to be able to train on the course that you're going to run in.
It's not always practical to have, you can't always train on the course. If you're going to run the Mount Fuji 100-miler, it doesn't make sense. I mean, if you can fly to Japan and get a week of training in on it, great, but you just kind of have to do as much homework as you can about the conditions and the course, and then try to simulate that at home. But I know, for example, Badwater, people training in Florida don't have a 15-mile road hill to go get on, but they train on bridges to get their hill training in. Now, is someone going to say that, the arc of a bridge is going to match the pitch of a mountain? Definitely not. But you do the best you can with what you have.
So Jimmy, I'm with you 100%. And what I could have done different is to make sure I didn't take those, 5:30 morning runs and made sure they were more 5:30 afternoon runs in the heat, because we have plenty of heat here in the valley in California and Sacramento area. We have plenty of hills out here that are challenging to climb. So next time, what I need to do is to make sure that I'm in the PM times running in the heat and working those hills and realizing that is just critical. It's not, I would trade off many morning workouts and substitute even miles during the week to make sure that I was in the heat. So I would.
So Don, So Don, was that your main takeaway from what you mean you need to train in similar conditions? The hill work you did enough of, but the climate, the heat, you did not.
I would say that would be it. I need to put myself in the heat more than I did, and so next time, that's what I should do. Kate, you were about to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say, we actually didn't run in a tremendous amount of heat prior either. We did what we could, but we were out of town a lot. And one thing that we really did do the week, 2 weeks out for a few weeks, was do a lot of sauna training, which to me, like, that made all the difference in how I managed the heat out in AC. I honestly didn't really have a lot of problems running wise from the heat. I had some stomach issues that I've never had before, which could have been caused by the heat, but we just made a commitment to do quite a few sauna sessions each week for, you just sit in the sauna and train your body to drink more water and sweat less electrolytes, and that made a huge difference. So even if you don't have access to running in the heat, or you don't want to go run in a sweater or something like that, definitely find a sauna.
Stan, what did you do for heat training?
We belong to Cal Fit, and we, like, 3 weeks out, did 2 weeks consecutive of I believe it was seven to eight sessions, and I tried to stay in there as long as I could. And I think I only got up to about 55 minutes
in the sauna.
In the sauna, yeah. And so also I work construction, and I'm outside, so I think that helps out a lot too.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So that was one thing I usually do pretty well with on the hot races is doesn't bug me too much. I'm used to it.
Yeah, that's good, because I'm in 72 degrees weather inside the place that I work. And I have a membership at Cal Fit, and I haven't been in there since, I don't even want to tell you when. I'm helping support your gym. I should have been in that sauna.
It's like most people, though. That
hey, Don, next time you can also, when you sign up for Angeles Crest, 6 months out, take a job as a contractor.
I'll show them around. I don't mind.
I will quit my job and I'll go back to my days in construction. I think I can still run a shovel pretty well. And I like how you say next time, because I've already received from Katie DeSplinter a message that said there are 80 people that have already signed up for AC, and you better get on it if you want to get on it.
Isn't that about half, right?
Well, I will not be releasing this podcast until I get my name in.
Yeah, you better edit that part out, Don.
Hey, Don, I was going to say, why don't you just turn the temperature, the thermostat up in your office and crank that baby on to 95 degrees and tell your patients you're doing heat therapy.
Bikram chiropractic. Very nice. Yeah.
Aren't your patients supposed to be like have warm muscles anyway? Wouldn't that be good for them?
We might try that out. Yeah. When it gets hot, I'll just open the doors and save a little money too and do a little heat training. Now, I want to say something about Kate, because, this is the first race that I've run with Kate, and I was extremely impressed. And I'm going to give you a couple of these shots that I saw visually, Kate, and then you can kind of comment and fill us in on it. We were, I don't know what mile it is, around the 40s, when we were coming through the through that road section, and you were running with Sally. And you guys were having the greatest time. Cars were honking and saying, "Woo! Look at these girls running!" And I was behind, just taking it all in. And it was a lot of fun. And if there's ever a view that's gonna get you to Pasadena from the start, it's following two very fit ladies. I said, "This'll carry me all the way in." And you guys were having a great time. And then we get into this Cooper Canyon. And for those that have not run AC, Cooper Canyon is a treat, because they take all of the air out of Cooper Canyon and they add extra heat. And it is a place for, they could do scientific experiments in there, because there's no other, it's not too many places like it, because you don't have the air there and the oxygen and things that you really need and can disrupt scientific experiments. So we're running through that area and we're going through some switchbacks and making a climb. And all of a sudden I see Kate, who was ahead of me before, which I couldn't catch with her 302 marathon legs. And she's out in front. And then all of a sudden I see her, and then I look and she's stopped by a tree, and she says, "I've got a few stomach issues here." And then I get a switchback ahead of her, and I look back and I see the toughest, most determined face ever. She's just solid on her game, working through this issue. And so we're not even halfway through the race. She goes from laughing, giggling, greatest time ever, to resolved. I'm going to beat this. I've got to get through this. Talk to us about the high and the low that was just 15 minutes apart, Kate.
Yeah, it was interesting. And one of the things I learned is when it's hot out and you feel good, don't push it. I was feeling fantastic, obviously, as you saw, and through that canyon. And I knew that canyon pretty much always sucks the life out of people. However, I didn't really adjust my pace. I just kept kind of hammering it and passing people and just having fun. And out of nowhere, my stomach, I've never really had a stomach problem that stopped me from running in a race. So I'm pretty lucky in that regards. It turned out to be later what I found out to be is acid reflux, which I'd never even had before. And I think it was just combining some of the wrong foods a little too close together in the heat. I was using Vitargo, which was great. However, I ran out. I didn't bring enough for the canyon. And then when I ran out and I knew I needed to take my next section of calories, all I had was gels. So I had a gel, which I don't think the mix that close together worked for my stomach, obviously. And it felt like I had a softball size of air, like right in between my rib cage about to explode. It was really painful. So I kept trying to just power through, and I found I could kind of power and then I'd have to stop and sit and kind of let it pass a little bit. Just kept trying to hammer it. And I eventually got up to that aid station way past when my crew thought I was going to be there. I had to sit and just Katie DeSplinter was on my crew, who you mentioned earlier, and she luckily was able to figure out what it was because she had it for a little while at Western States. So she eventually got me kind of back on track, but it took a long time. It took like 20 miles, to be honest.
So what did she do? What kind of magic did she
In her experience, it was actually starting to drink something carbonated. I learned later in the race from, I think it was Jack Chang. Is that his last name? Jack Chang? Yeah, I learned way later in the race from Jack Chang that the best thing to do with acid reflux is actually to sit down for 15, 20 minutes and not move and let it fully pass. Whereas I only sat down for probably a tops of like 10 minutes. So I never quite let it heal itself. And then I also later talked to my chiropractor, and apparently my stomach was positioned in some weird high, I don't know, it was like too high or something. And he literally pushed it back down. It was the weirdest experience, but now I'm better.
Did you try any Tums, just some old conventional Tums with that acid reflux? Did that help?
I did when I got into the aid station, because I had a little kit inside of my bag that was like, you know, emergency type stuff. And I had some. But I also realized a lot of times Tums and Zantac and things like that, they actually cause your stomach to produce more acid at first and then less. So just the fact of having them in your stomach. So that's why I got worse, and then I eventually got better.
So the takeaway from you on that is what you said in the very beginning. If you're feeling fantastic, don't all of a sudden try to set a PR for that next 5K or 10K. Just stay on course.
In the heat, specifically in the heat, and specifically in like the first half of the race, because I wasn't even halfway through and I felt great in the heat. And I honestly already learned this lesson when I did when I ran Javelina 100 out in Arizona. I did the same thing. I felt great at mile 30, 40, because I love 50Ks. I always feel great at mile 30. So I was pushing it. Same thing, had problems. So when it's hot and you feel good, don't push it.
How many times do you think we have to learn lessons on these things? Because I've learned a few lessons more than once.
Every single time.
Jimmy, how about you? What's a takeaway?
Well, as I said, each time I've done this race, I've had a different idea about the race and a different takeaway. And this time around, one of the lessons that was reiterated for me was a lot of the low points that I've had in this 100 and other hundreds, I managed my fluid, calorie, and electrolytes in a totally different way. I really upped the game on the amount of fluids I was taking in. And specifically, I had a, you know, 8-ounce solution I would drink at every single checkpoint, which was high in electrolytes and probably had about 150 calories in it. And if the checkpoints were an hour apart, 3 hours apart, every single time I got an opportunity, I would chug one of these solutions, and then I'd jump back out on the trail and continue, with the bottles that I had.
Jimmy, I'm going to interrupt you if I can just real quick. And I did the same thing and try to do the same thing. I take advantage of those aid stations, and I just down a 20-ounce bottle or whatever might be there, and I just throw it in because I know it needs to be inside of me to do any good, and I don't have to carry it in my hand, and then I still go out with two full bottles or whatever it is. And so I really do try to chug something at those aid stations and just force it in like good medicine.
Yeah, and my lows weren't as low as a result of that. And when I got to the points that I was having physical lows, there was no mental low. I was able to cross-reference my former low points and say, I'm struggling right now, but I'm not struggling as much as I have. And every time I didn't feel good, I reframed it. And my crew was upset that I wasn't more upset. They wanted to see more carnage and more devastation. And
for their entertainment, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They said the whole time I had a smile on my face and I was joking and sarcastic the whole way. And I think that helped me. I didn't have any train wrecks where I had to sit down for 15, 20, 30 minutes and pull it back together. And it was my shortest aid station time at Angeles Crest by a lot. In fact, my first AC in 2006, I had one aid station stop that equaled almost all of my aid station stops combined at AC this year.
Nice.
So I learned that I could keep moving forward and manage things on the fly. And even when I had my low point, my lowest point came around between mile 60 and 65. And I overheated. I threw up a couple of times. And there's a big, long, dusty fire road downhill into a canyon before you start a 5-kilometer climb up to the checkpoint at aid stations, mile 68, Newcomb's Saddle. And I knew there was a creek at the base of this descent before the big climb. And I actually thought to myself, when I get down to that creek, I'm going to sit in the creek for a little bit. And I'd done that once before in a very, very hot race in Rio del Lago, 2008. I sat down, I took my shoes and socks off. I submerged in the creek where the water was moving the quickest and just spent 5-6 minutes getting the body temperature down. And once I did that, I pretty much ran strong the last 35 miles of the race. And that, the temperature was also dropping slightly because the sun was going down, but there were some 75 and 80 degree air temperature readings in the last marathon of the race in the overnight section. So it didn't get super cool, but I ran pretty well after that. So kind of learning, reinforcing that managing things in the exact moment, no matter how, you're in a race, you don't want to take your shoes and socks off and sit in a creek. But at that time, that was the thing to help manage my overheating.
Well, you're in a 100-mile race. So there's, you have to do things. It's not a 5K. So, taking those 5 to 10 minutes and repairing the body or resetting, Control-Alt-Deleting your body and bringing core temperature back to allow you to feel more like you did when you were feeling good, you can make up a lot of ground when you're feeling good, and you can lose a lot of ground when you're feeling bad.
Absolutely. It always reminds me of that scene from Unbreakable when Jeff Rose sits in the river too, the river crossing, and then he comes back just fierce.
Yeah, I think even if I'm feeling good, I'm going to start sitting in river crossings. I'm not even going to pass one without getting in. It's like, it's only mile 7. Yeah, but I'm getting in. Yeah, how many times, let's throw this around the table and get everybody's input. And how many times through a race do you experience or do you expect to experience, however you want to answer it, the lows? Because you go through good times and bad times. How many times do you prepare yourself mentally to enter just the darkest, roughest spots? And let's start with whomever. Stan, you're right across from me. What do you think?
It's hard to say a number. It's going to be there. It'll get real dark.
Yeah.
From my experiences, it's been for a while, you know, during a race. And so, three or four times, honestly, you know, I expect to be pretty down, pretty out, down and out. So,
do you come out of all of them, or once you get into one, do you stay there permanently, never to come out again until, you know, a week?
No. It comes and goes, you know, and so far I've always ended pretty much on a high. Mm-hmm. So, but it's definitely gets dark, you know, and you just got to be ready for it and just kind of put your head down and just keep moving forward.
Yeah. So, who's up next?
I don't, again, I don't just like Stan, I don't think I have a number either, but I just know that part of it is the ups and the downs, and I try to, you know, enjoy both, because, you know, we're putting ourselves through this, might as well, you know, just kind of see how your brain reacts and how you, what you do with the lows. How I approach it is I try not to get overly invested in any particular feeling, whether it's good or bad. Because I feel like if we get too invested in, oh, I feel great right now, I'm going to keep feeling great, then the low gets that much lower.
Good point.
So, of course, I enjoy it, the highs and the lows, but, you know, I just, like, expect that it's going to change.
Scott War.
You know, I don't have as many long distance experiences as this great panel. But I would probably agree with Stan. For me, you know, three or four, and, you know, I actually, in preparation for my 100 the miler that I ran, is I would actually at night visualize, you know, kind of go into a self-hypnotic trance, if you will, and visualize going into just a bad, evil place where everything hurts and you're almost near death. And I visualize myself coming out of it. Like Kate said, know that it's going to get better. It can't last forever. You talk to any experienced ultra runner, and they say they especially in the 100 milers, you go into that dark place. But guess what? They don't stay in that dark place. Every single person I've talked to that's run a 100 miler never says at mile 78, I went into a dark place and stayed there for the remaining 22 miles. It's relatively short, I think. So that's what I would do, is I would visualize what it was like or what it could be like, and then visualize myself coming out of it and coming out of it stronger than I went in.
And I'm with you on that, Scott. I know that you do come out of them, and I've been in enough of them, and each one of them go away after a period of time, and each one of them has a reason. You know, either I don't have enough hydration, my electrolytes are off, my fuel's off, my pace is off, it's been hot and I haven't been taking care of myself and didn't find that creek and passed it up because I thought, you know, I was going to set the new world's record, which was over probably after the gun went off in the beginning. So there's always a reason, and I try to work through that. What have I done? You know, and then it becomes the figure out what's going on and where I slipped, and look back on when I was feeling good and what may have happened along the way. So it becomes a thinking man's game, like Jimmy said in the beginning. Where was the slip? So I like trying to figure that out and knowing that you can get out of it. And if you haven't been in it and know that you can get out of it, just know that you can get out of it. They get, you know, better.
Can I input one little quick interjection here? It's very easy when you get, at least for me, when you get into that dark place to thinking, why am I in this place? Did I not eat enough? Did I not drink enough? Did I not train enough? And start questioning your preparation or your actions that day, rather than thinking, just get out of it. And I think that you can easily get captured into thinking on the negative things and what did I do versus what am I going to do to get out of this?
Yeah, totally.
A total psychological game.
There's an important, very important point there, which is, there's two questions that people ask themselves when they're in a low spot. One is, what did I do wrong? And one is, what can I do now? The what did I do wrong people, if you will, spend all this time in despair about how their training could have been different, how they could have done in a heat race more sauna acclimation, how they should have had more calories or electrolytes up to that point. it's a wasted energy, because only the what can I do now will improve the situation.
Let me defend my comment, because when I say what did I do, it's for me, and I'm with you, Jimmy, and your point needs to be recognized and respected. But to defend myself, when I say what did I do, it's only to figure out what am I going to do next, how am I going to change it, what am I going to fix. So I'm with that. But you're right. The people that try to close the chapter for that race start looking for the excuse that's going to make the conclusion of that particular event, and so they can exit and know why they had to exit. But I've never questioned the amount of training, because I think you can, even on pretty minimal training, you can go do some extraordinary things if you manage yourself properly. You just have to back off. And I think about that quite a bit. I think, okay, here's the vehicle. This is the part I like. Here's the vehicle I'm going in with. This is what I have. And I think I can do 100 mile on pretty minimal stuff, and I could do 100 mile on a lot of stuff. And I like to say, here's what I have. How am I going to manage this vehicle that I've prepared at this point to make it through this event? And so that's what I like about it. You can go in with just minimal training and still do it if you're smart.
Jim, the same thing with you. You said that you do some of your best running and racing when you have the least amount of training, right? Or your experiences?
It's not so much that I race better with less training. It's that when I've been in the best shape of my life, I've neglected my race plan.
Overrun.
I think when I come in a little bit undertrained, I spend a lot more time focusing on all the things that I can control and manage, and I'm much more mindful and reactive to all of the things that are happening. So I'm dealing with things when they're small problems instead of waiting until they're catastrophes. To answer the original question, how many times do I expect to have a low spot in a race? I don't usually measure it in terms of distance. I measure it in terms of hours. I generally expect a low spot every 5 to 8 hours. And part of it can be just the cycle of the body's energy, just the rhythm of a day. If you look at a normal day, you're going to have low spots in any normal day where your blood sugar sags, where you're bored out of your mind, where you just don't feel as good as you do at other times. And when I get myself into those spots, a little mantra or a little thing I say to myself is, this is exactly how this is supposed to feel right now. And then I move into what can I do now to improve my situation. And if I'm constantly doing little things right now to improve my situation, then I'm doing the most that I can to move forward. But in a 100 miler, I generally experience two or three low points. I had a 34 and a half hour Badwater finish where I experienced about five. So I think in a 50 miler, I might only go through one of those spots. So I think it's a time-based thing, and it's a matter of how much you let things spin out of control. And the physical suffering is going to happen, but you don't have to emotionally suffer on top of it.
Let me throw this out for some feedback. Have you ever had a low point coming through a finish line? I never have.
Neither have I.
Right?
Nope.
I mean, so that tells you that the very last part of the race, if you're feeling good, you can feel good in any part of the race.
Yep.
So does that beg the question that when you do enter that dark spot, that you never, ever question whether you're going to come out?
I never question whether I'm going to come out, and I never question my the amount of training or preparation. Right. I just know I am where I am, and I can do it no matter, because the vehicle that I'm in can do it. I just need to adjust.
Jim, what was the ratio of actual training versus psychological that you go through in a 100-mile race?
I like this, yeah.
You know, it didn't you say it's like 80-20 or 70-30 in your opinion?
Running 100 milers is 90% mental, and the other 10% is in your head.
So that just proves right there you could do it. I mean, you know, and hardly any training at all, right?
I say it's all about, it's all about stakes. If you had a mother and that mother's child was taken away from her and put in harm's way at the other end of a mountain range, and you told that mother, your child is in danger, you have to go 100 miles on these trails to get to your child, it doesn't matter how little training that mother had, she'd find a way to get there. So I kind of say that everyone's capable of doing this distance. The reason that we train is to enjoy it more, to lower injury risk, to help the body recover quicker, and, you know, to get through it a little bit quicker than you would if you were completely untrained. It's just a matter of the enjoyment of it. You know, we all love to run. We all love being in nature. So the more fit you are going into it, the better plan that you have, the more you can enjoy a higher percentage of those miles.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I've played those psychological games for myself too. I've said my family, wife and two daughters, are ready to get on a ship and they're going to sail away. And I need to get to them before that ship launches so that I can, you know, give them this message whenever it might be. And so I'm running thinking, this is my mission. I've got to get it done. And, you know, that helps carry me through for a little while. Then, you know, then something else comes up or, you know, whatever the case, but I've used that as a motivator for me. Anybody else have any psychological trickery that they do on themselves?
I'm a big person of seeing family and friends and my crew. And so I just focus on getting in when I have hard spots, is to focus on getting to the next checkpoint to see them. You know, familiar faces always makes you feel better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, crew is important.
You know, I have a question for Jimmy. This is was your fourth time at AC, and what number 100 miler?
11th.
11th, 1100 milers. What did you learn new on this last 100 miler?
That, I don't know. I had a lot of stuff reinforced. I'm trying to think of what was completely new to me.
What was the most powerful lesson that you relearned?
That I love people that do ultra marathons. We're all competing as hard as we can and trying to do the best that we can for ourselves. And I caught up to a buddy of mine at mile 97, and he's a new buddy. He's someone that I competed against at the Rio del Lago 100 miler, which was his first 100 just last year. And his name's Toshi Hosaka. He's a member of the Quicksilver running club in the San Jose area. And Toshi and I met at that Rio del Lago race the day after the race in a hotel parking lot. And it's funny because I didn't even know his name, but he was the guy that I was trying to run away from at the end of that Rio del Lago. And I ended up finishing in second and he finished in third. Well, when I saw his name pop up on the Angeles Crest race roster, the joy of social media and Facebook, I looked him up and I said, hey, I see you're coming down to LA. Why don't you come down, you know, a month and a half early and we'll run some of the trails and I'll show you some of the tricky spots of the race. So we got out for two really awesome days of training together, and a handful of other coyotes came out and trained with us. We did an overnight training run on the last section of the course and then the midpoint to the 75 mile point. So we got a lot of running in together. And I think, you know, we were both rooting for each other to do well, but we both just wanted to do a little bit better than the other guy. And every time I was at a checkpoint, I was asking people, you know, where's Toshi? How far ahead is he? And he at one point was like 45 minutes ahead of me. So, but I never gave up on that. Like I constantly was pushing to catch him. And I catch him at mile 97. And he looks up and he goes, Jimmy, damn. And we had this really funny exchange that I'll never forget. He goes, I just want you to know that I've been training to sprint the finish. And I said, Tosh, you know, we're both shooting for sub 23 hours. We both have that locked up. I'm like, if we're going to race right now, I know this section of the course really, really well. I'm going to put a lot of distance on you. And you're not going to be able to sprint the finish. I'm like, why don't we just run it in together? And he goes, you mean like finish together? And I was like, yeah. So we ran the last 3 miles together and got our 22 hour, 38 minute finish. So yep. We each had our 22:38 finish and crossed the line together. And it was just a really sweet way to wrap up the weekend. It was one of my favorite memories in four Angeles Crest attempts.
Who finished first on the finish line, the finish results?
It's interesting as we discovered that Angeles Crest does not recognize ties. And we looked later and they had put me in sixth and Tosh in seventh, 1 second behind. And I didn't think that that was right in that I was the one that talked him into not racing the last section. So I talked to Andy, the guy that manages the finishing results. And I said, hey, you need to flip us. And he's like, you're arguing for being a lower position. I don't think that's ever happened in the history of this race.
And Jimmy, like, yeah. you are a stud. I can't believe you did that. That is so cool of you.
Well, the funny thing about it, and the other thing that speaks to the nature of a high percentage of ultra runners, is Toshi, I think, saw the results with me in sixth and him in seventh and didn't say a word. And when he got called up to accept his award, he realized that they had flipped it. And he argued to have it switched back again. And at the end of the day, Toshi and I had a funny exchange after the race as well. And he said, look, next year we're fighting all the way to the finish. And I said, all right. So Tosh signed up again. I signed up again. And, a fledgling rivalry is born.
Hey, Jim, if you want to flip with my time, I'm okay to change with you, okay? Just so you know, I have no problem with that.
Yeah, me too.
I'd be happy to do that. You just got to be closer.
Nice. Yeah. Here's one of the takeaways that I had. And this happened at the very beginning of the race for me. And I was running with a guy, and I'm sorry, I don't know his name, but he's run the race seven or nine times. I forget. Many times. And as I'm right behind him, and we're hiking up one of the first climbs, and he reminded us that we need to stay within ourselves, that this is far too early, mile 10-ish, right, to be worried about on your left, can I get around you? You know, all the uptight stuff that people are doing. And then I had this like this epiphany, and I thought, you know, if I'm traveling at this pace, this was behind the person that I want to say on your left, right? Because I felt like I'm ready to go on your left. And so I'm traveling at that pace, and I'm thinking, if I was moving at this pace at mile 85 and 90, would I be satisfied? And I thought, I would be very satisfied if I'm moving at this pace. So I just need to mellow out. And I need to make sure that what I'm doing on the first part of this race, if I would be satisfied on the second part of the race, then I need to just mellow out and stay back and stay within myself and stay even on this whole thing and not have a faster, better performing first half and a bit slower performing second half because I beat myself up and wore myself out. So that became kind of a new kind of a thought process or a check-in. And I thought to myself, do I really need to go around this person or should I back off a little bit and not try to be such a fast runner right now and impress myself with how quick I am? No, I just need to back off a bit and travel like I want to travel on the last 20 miles on the first 20 miles. Anybody think that that's something that I should do?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with that 100% too.
I mean, I think I put everybody to sleep.
I didn't even know there was a question there.
Oh, it wasn't a question. I just need a little support. I couldn't stretch that concept out any further. I took up 3 minutes. So that's my new mantra, Jimmy. My mantra is, you know, to run the first part like the second part and just be even and just stay steady all the way through. It's a 100-mile endurance run. And so I'm going to treat it that way.
Yeah.
Well done, Don.
Thanks.
Bravo.
Okay. Anybody else have some takeaways? Because I still have some on my list.
In that same kind of vein, when we were on the Baden-Powell climb, which is the highest, it goes up to the highest elevation on the course.
About mile, what, 26-ish?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's that whole section. So it's from what, 12 to 26. So 12 to whatever. Anyways, it goes up to, I think, 9.5, something like that. And I traditionally get a little bit of headache at over like 8,000. And then in all my training runs, I had had some trouble out on that climb. And I got behind a few people on that climb who I was thinking to myself, I'm faster than these people, I should pass them. But I was really enjoying the conversation because it was just hilarious and the stories were awesome. So I just stayed in that little crew and hiked real slow up that climb. And then I realized I was at 9,000 and I felt awesome. And I was able to just start running. And I ran, you know, all the way down to the next aid station. And that's when I caught up and got to run with Sally. And I think it was a lot because I just kept it easy and didn't try to pass people and just had fun.
Yeah, it's amazing when the conversation, you, how much it makes time fly, you know, it's awesome.
And I've done that on that exact, both times I've run this race at Baden-Powell. And I know just from looking at the profile, this potentially could be a very, very difficult spot that could wound me and, you know, make the rest of my day very, very miserable. And so I pick those spots on the run and I say, no matter what, this cannot take me out. I need to be healthy all the way through this thing, from the bottom to the middle to the top. I need to make sure I provide enough nutrients, enough fluid, make sure I back off enough. So when I get to the top of that thing, that I say, I've conquered you and I'm fine and you didn't take me down and I'm going to move on with the race. But I look at those challenging spots and say, no matter what, I've got to stay even through this thing and stay in good health.
Yeah, Baden-Powell, when I got up there, I screamed at the top of the mountain.
Said, did you?
Yeah, it was a difficult section, and got up there and looked around and realized how high I was, and I screamed and then got moving again.
Did you give a coyote yell? Because I heard several of those coyote yells throughout there.
A few times, yeah.
Well, I gave a ton of those.
I could tell when the coyotes were going to the aid station because there was all kinds of coyote yelling going on. Yeah, I said,
yelping.
Yeah, there's an aid station coming up. I hear the coyotes going.
Yeah, we're not quiet down here.
Okay, I've got another one. So people are, because, you know, I learned a lot of lessons. I got at least two entry fees out of this race worth of lessons. So I doubled my money. I learned that when your stomach goes south and you just, nothing looks good, you feel like you're going to vomit, then you know what? You need to vomit. That you need to clear that stomach, because when I clear the stomach, I felt better. I felt miserable. I'm trying to hold it off. I'm going, I don't want to get sick. I don't want to. You know, have that part of my story that, you know, I lost my stomach and I had to get sick. But so I fought it for a while. And then as soon as I said, that's it, clearing the stomach, all of a sudden things got even again. Like Sonny Blende says, clear the stomach, reset that stomach. Mm-hmm. And it's really true. I felt better. So I would bend over, vomit, and then pass the person that had just passed me. And they kind of shook their head going, what in the heck? Now, how, you were just bending over getting sick. Yeah, you feel better after you get some of that bad stuff out, and you can start putting good stuff back in. Because I think I was running for a long, long time without processing anything. Stomach was sour. It's not happy. I'm just sloshing around stuff. I'm not digesting anything. It's unhappy. I'm not processing anything. So time to get rid of it and restart. So I learned, clear that stomach early. Now, not before your race. I don't think you should show up to the start line with your finger down your throat. I don't think that's too early, but if you're fighting your stomach, go ahead and hit reset.
Man, I guess I need to practice that. I should work that into my training. What,
force vomiting?
I couldn't get myself to do it. I don't know why. I probably would have helped, but.
But when I saw you by that tree, if I saw you by that tree, should I have assisted you?
Yeah, you know, maybe. Good to know. Another takeaway I got too was, I really was good about the caffeine. I didn't have any caffeine until I needed it. And at nighttime, I mean, I was out there for a long time. I also went into this race a little cocky, thinking, I'll finish 25 to 27 hours. It took me over 29 hours. And I was focused. I never got tired. Mainly, I think it was because I learned quickly. I needed to, once I started taking caffeine, to keep taking caffeine every half an hour for me to not get tired. And I felt actually awesome. And I was super focused and mentally totally aware and there and present and strong.
So, yes.
Yes, no caffeine early. And I would not recommend taking caffeine in the heat. That was my takeaway.
I've got another takeaway. when the sun goes down, you need to replace it with something that's equivalent to the sun. It's hard to run at night. Now, last time I was short of, I didn't have any light.
A heat lamp.
I had a few, you know, miscalculations with aid stations and things of that nature. So this time at 3:30 in the afternoon, and so the sun's not going to go down for what, another 5 hours? I had a light with me. Now, I've never carried a light for like 5 hours, but I've got that sucker. But what I didn't do was take my brightest light. I thought, I'll just take this substandard light just because it's a little, it's not quite as heavy. And, you know, I just feel like, you know, that's good enough. Well, that turned out to be my only night light for the night, just because things happen as they happen. Mm-hmm. There was a point that I was running that I mentioned to another runner. I don't know if I would rather trade for a new set of legs or a new set of eyes right now, because I can't see anything. And those guys marked the course perfectly. But, you know, through that section, I don't even know what miles it is, around 72-ish, 3-ish, you're going through some of these campsites. And whoever has that organic flower, is that what you called it, Jimmy? Organic flower? Yep. They have marked every high spot and low spot and possible trip zone, providing you have a decent light. But if you don't have a decent, they looked at some of them and said, this would never be a problem. If you don't have a light, that one's the problem. So I did run into a few of them, but those guys did an excellent job marking the course. And so I learned that you need more light, more better. And
yeah, two good lights is ideal. I also learned, my husband's awesome and got me a new bright headlamp that was the best one ever. And I gave it to my crew in the box. I didn't even take it out of the box. And apparently it was a little harder to put together than I thought it would be. So it took I think about 20 miles to get the strap position so it could actually go on my head. So I ran a long time in the nighttime holding my headlamp in my hand, which was fine. I don't mind. But it was pretty hysterical. So, yeah, put your headlamp and gear together before the race.
There we go.
Duh. Oh, wow.
That was a good one.
I would have more things, what I've learned, but I only made it to mile 38, so I only learned so much.
You've run other hundreds, though, so you know anything comes to mind, you can pitch in there. Jimmy, you tell us about your lights, because I gave you my little light excuse. I said the light difference separated us, Jimmy, by 5 hours this year. Okay, so I figure, you know, next year with a decent light, I can make that 5 hours up. I'm sure that was the 5 hours I'm missing with Jimmy. Tell us about your lamps. What are you using? What do you recommend? What do you think's just the bomb diggity?
I discovered on zombierunner.com a couple of Phoenix lighting deals. The HP 11 headlamp is on its highest setting on, I think they call it the turbo setting. We call it a ghetto bird. It's so bright that you could track a suspect.
It's awesome.
So I use it on the second rating, and I think that the second setting is still like 110, 150 lumens. And then we have a Phoenix handheld flashlight. It's a $25 flashlight that operates on a single AA battery. And if you put a lithium battery in that single, you know, spot, it's so light you almost forget that it's there. And the flashlight's so small, you could hold a handheld water bottle and still have the flashlight kind of tucked in between a couple fingers. And that flashlight is also 100 lumens. And having two sources of light helped a lot this year in terms of running some of the late race rocky technical sections. So I think I spent a little under $100 between the headlamp and the flashlight. And then I splurged a little bit on the lithium batteries. Probably spend another $15-$20 on the appropriate amount of lithium batteries.
Don't say a little bit, Jim. How much were those batteries?
They're like $15-$20 for like pack four.
Yeah.
Well cheap. Worth it. Well worth it.
How much is a silver buckle? I'll tell you that.
Longer.
Yeah, that's the silver buckle was worth every penny.
Well, think about just all the training you put into it. I mean, come on. Splurge on the batteries.
I've paid the
Kirkland $10 for 30 of them, and I've never had an issue with nighttime. And
well, you're a little tougher.
By far take longer than you guys to get across that finish line, so I've been all right with that. But
I just looked up the Phoenix FENIX HP 11, the maximum 277 lumens. Jimmy, did you have to get a license for this light?
Yeah, well, they say don't put your hand directly in front of the light or you'll burn it.
You know, I'm sure that could start a fire in the grassy areas in the late summer when they're very dry. You need to make sure you're glancing left and right and not staring anywhere.
I did. I looked straight ahead.
Do you have to put sunscreen on before you use this headlamp?
On your hands if they pass in front of the light at all, yeah.
Okay.
All right, so I got a chance to do one thing that you're not supposed to do, which is try something new on race day, right? I mean, who hasn't heard that? And so I made a radical shoe change. I received this new shoe a week before the race. So I had some time with it, and I wore it on two short runs, because how much do you run on taper week, right? Not much. And so I had, you know, total maybe 20 miles, if that, in these shoes. But I did have a crew this time. And so I figured I'll put the crew out in front of me, and they'll have a change of back to my traditional shoe if I need them. If these start to fail on me, I have a quick plan B. And so that was my plan. The first 25 miles I ran in my shoe that's the gold standard that I really love. It's a La Sportiva Crosslight 2. That's what I was wearing out there and like it. And then at mile 25, I changed into the Hoka. Oh, the Hoka. Let me tell you, that shoe is comfortable. That shoe is kind. I learned that normally around mile 45-ish, 55-ish, I start to experience a little bit of medial knee pain. I get some achiness going on because that's a long ways to run. I find at mile 70-ish, I feel some bottom of my foot pain because I've been slapping it on Mother Earth for most of the day. But the Hoka was very kind to me. I didn't have any knee pain. I didn't have any feet pain. And I just cruised around. A lot of times I was distracted just thinking, how nice are these shoes? And you're up there a little bit higher because there's a lot of cushion on them. And I thought, I'm going to end up tripping in these things. But I didn't. Even with the technical terrain that AC gives you, because one thing AC does give you is a chance to watch every step. You cannot really take in too many places a vacation and just kind of put it on automatic pilot. So I found that my takeaway was nice shoe, and I've enjoyed running in it since.
Right on.
Scott War, are you still there? Because I saw you slip out for a second. You just got a pair of Hokas. What's your thought on the Hoka?
You know what? I am falling in love. I'm Twitter-pated right now with the Hoka, but I'm falling in love with the Hoka. They're pretty amazing shoes. I've had to kind of eat crow with a lot of the friends that I've been preaching the minimalist movement to, and now I'm wearing these space shoes. I like them because go ahead.
No, sorry.
They're maximalist, but Kate's getting stuck on the zero drop factor.
It is a zero drop.
Well, four millimeters. There's 4 millimeter drop front to the rear.
I like them because it makes me about 5'10". So it's my ego.
They do make some nice ones that could pass for maybe some business casual. There's some darker shoe. You could wear them, Scott.
My wife calls them the shape-up shoes.
They look somewhat like shape-up, yeah, but I tell you, they don't run like shape-ups. I've never been in a shape-up, but
maybe
I like
this shoe.
Maybe you
need to try some shape-ups.
So if you're an older guy like Scott Warren and I, because we've been labeled the OGs on this program, I tell you, it does make you feel about 25 again. So I like the shoe. For you, for those of you that are young, like the rest of the group on the panel, you didn't really, you know, why the Hoka? You know, you're already young. You already have that cushion at the bottom of your foot. Your knees are good. Your hips are good. Your back's good. So just, you know, keep rolling with what you got.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. But if you wear a size 12 and you'd like to try mine on, Jimmy, I got a pair for you.
I'm good. I like things with swooshes on them.
I know you're a swoosh guy. I don't even, you know, I mean, heck, swooshes. You're one of the few swooshers, but you're running a 22-38. I might have to relook at the swoosh. Here's, I'm going to share another thing that I have just discovered that I need to pay more attention to, and I'm really working hard on it, and that's sleep. I think that I've got to sleep more. We've been talking about that on some podcasts, but I'm becoming an advocate of that. I was just reading a thing about heat stroke, and it talked about three of the things that can contribute to heat stroke, and it said insufficient training. Okay, I'm good with that. We started the podcast talking a little bit about, not having enough time to acclimate, not doing enough training sessions in the sauna. So insufficient training, yes, that could be a heat stroke problem. The next thing it said, dehydration. Yeah, we know that. I mean, if you're not drinking, you can't cool yourself down, because we need fluids. And the third thing they put on there was sleep. It said sleep deprivation. Not enough sleep can be an issue. And I'm thinking to myself, what isn't that an issue for? If you're ill, you need sleep. If you need to perform better, apparently you need to get the rest. And that's part of taper. It's rest. So I'm really committed to sleeping more. And that's hard to do. We have so much going on, but I'm committed to sleeping.
Only so many hours in a day,
Yep. So, Scott, I can't meet you in the morning because I'm sleeping. No run.
You can sleep while you're running.
Yeah, I've had to do that a few times. Jimmy Dean, do we still have you? Did you float out on our great Skype line here?
We're here.
Right on. Okay. Well, we learn a lot. We go out in the run 100 miles. It's unavoidable. We run one next week. We're going to have a number of lessons. Some reminded to us, like Jimmy has told us, he was reacquainted with some of old lessons, but there were new ones along the way. There were for me. Maybe that's why we do it, because there's just no way to get around it. You're going to come across some things that you expect, some things that you don't, but it's within each one of us to manage it, manipulate it, to turn it into our favor. And it defines who we are: competitors, fierce survivors on the planet. That's how our ancestors survived. That's how we're surviving, because we just don't say no, and we just keep saying go. And maybe that's why we love the sport that we do, because there's adversity and we can overcome it. And that's what I like about it. So with that, anybody final comments?
Spirit had final comments.
Spirit's the dog, the Freeman dog over there.
Speak.
Trail Runner Nation members, join a discussion. Go onto the website at www.trailrunnernation.com. We can be found at Twitter at @WeAreNation. Jimmy Dean can be found. Jimmy, give us some of your contacts over there with the Coyotes and yourself.
CoyoteRunning.com. You can find Coyote Running on Facebook and Twitter. And I tweet at twitter.com/CoachJimmyDean.
Jimmy Dean, you're always adding all the numbers and the letters. That's good, because the FCC demands that. I'm glad that you're so obedient to that, because you could lose your Twitter license. Go out and run.
Moss.
All right, guys. I think I learned a lot from just talking with you guys.
Good.
Hey, Jim, for the record, I told you I signed up back for ACT, right?
I know.
All right. Just making sure you heard that.
Dang.
For the record, I didn't. But I'm going to go sub-3 marathon, and I'm going to get even faster than that. So
that's Kate, wow. Kate, so could you be talked into it? Because DeSplinter signed up.
Well, someone's got to crew all you fools.
Dominic signed up. So, I mean, heck.
I'm going to crew Jimmy to make sure he beats Toshi.
Nice.
If I move Jimmy again, he's going top, Jeez.
I promised myself I wasn't going to do that thing again.
No, I actually, what's cool is I actually do look forward to doing another 100, whereas 3 years ago I did not. But now I look forward to it. I will definitely do AC again, but I'll probably do another 100 towards the end of the year next year, towards the fall next year, but I really got to get on my marathon goals, so.
Don, you got to put your crap together to get your silver buckle before you get too old to do it.
Yeah. No,
Oh, that's cruel.
I understand that. What's the oldest guide ever to silver on that thing? How close am I?
60. UC, my first year, when I was freaking 28 years old or whatever, I ran like 26 and a half, and a 60-year-old UC ran 23:40 or something like that.
Yeah,
UC.
Yeah, UC.
What is that?
He's run every single.
He's run every AC. He's finished 25 out of 25.
I've got a picture of him, Scott, with standing. I was standing. I thought that would bring me some luck. He had so many great questions for me. So I see him out there at the beginning, you know, the day before, and he goes, "So what?" Because he's Swedish, and he, you know, his full on accent. He goes,
"He's Finnish."
Finnish, yeah.
He's from Finland.
Sorry, Finnish. That's appropriate for a guy that's finished 25 times. I thought that's just because he had finished so many times. And he goes, "What kind of shoes you're going to wear?" I said, "I'm going to wear it." He goes, "Oh, you think that's a good idea?" I'm thinking, "Well, not that you've said that. I don't know."
I hope so.
And he goes, "Well, what is that you're wearing on your wrist?" And I saw that's, you know, a watch. And he says, "Are you going to use that?" I'm second guessing everything now.
Are you going to use your watch?
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious.
He goes, "Well, what are you going to run it in?" And of course, you know, I've showed up to run a sub 24. And I go, "Sub 24." And he goes, "Oh, you think so?" I'm thinking, "Oh, great." He could see it. Anyway, good guy.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started into hum. Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come. Best is yet to come, and babe, won't that be fine? You think you've seen the sun.